Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the School of Economic Science annual economic lecture. My name is Peter Bowman. I'll act as chair this evening. My job is to introduce our speaker, who I have great pleasure in introducing, Mr. Ian Mason, who is the principal of the School of Economic Science and also head of the Economics and Law Faculty, and has been in that role now a number of years, leading the faculty in its role of both teaching and studying the subject of economics. The title of this evening's talk is Progress with Prosperity. Amidst the turmoil of contemporary economic difficulties, many voices are calling for a new, more principled and ethical economics. The school has been one of those voices for many years. This year's lecture will look at key questions and possible answers with implications for everyone. It's your brief, Mr. Mason.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming out on this freezing evening to hear a lecture on economics. I've often said, I read it in a book somewhere some time ago, that the word economics is what they call death at the box office. But in the current times, of course, the concerns are such that even a word like economics begins to trouble people and begins to awaken their attention and begins even to demand their attention, because we see that our economic arrangements are not all that they should be, or all at least that we feel that they should be and could be. And hence the call that the chairman was just repeating for a more ethical and principled economics, which might just go some way to allowing human beings to live well and prosperously without causing harm and without running into the deep troubles that we seem to be facing at the present time. And there are many such voices, ranging from Nobel Prize winners in economics to the Prince of Wales to journalists and commentators the world over. But of course, the work of actually developing and coming to some formulation of a new economics is not so straightforward. It is one thing to demand change. It is rather more difficult to say what that change might be. A few weeks ago, I was speaking in Glasgow, and some of the protesters from Occupy Scotland turned up. And one of them, a young chap, said, "Yes, it's all very well protesting," he said, "and we're quite good at protesting, and we go out and we protest. But," he said, "the problem is, it's one thing to say what we don't like, but what about what we do like?" And I think there are three jobs, really. One is to, as it were, objectively and sensibly and carefully critique how things are. One is to see what the possibilities are. And by far the most difficult is to get from the one to the other. And while there are plenty who can critique and effectively critique and sensibly critique the present situation, there is not a great deal of agreement on possible alternatives or how to reach them. And I don't think the School of Economic Science is significantly better placed than anybody else to do that, except perhaps for one thing, and that is that we have at least considered the importance of an ethical foundation for economics ever since the school was founded in 1937. The school was founded on the basis that there is truth and there is justice, and that they are relevant to human affairs, and they can provide a guide for human affairs. And so the school set out to teach a form of economics which incorporated justice as a guiding principle. And it did so intending to follow the truth. I'm happy to say that we don't think we've arrived at the truth, because if we had, we would almost certainly be mistaken. Truth, I think, is a bit like the North Star. It gives a sense of direction, but the chances of actually getting there are very remote. But it does give a guide, because you can keep asking the question, is this true? And of course the question then is, well, how would you know? And what we've taken as an answer in the school is that it can't be true if the outcomes are unjust. And so if, for example, you were to advocate an economic philosophy that was based on the view that as long as I'm all right, everything's all right, it would become apparent quite quickly that that produced a certain amount of injustice, and you might conclude that that particular proposition is not true. So the truth, the idea, the question gives a dynamic, and so does the sense of justice. And if we aim to do anything with our courses, it is simply to foster that sense of justice, because it gives a basis for understanding how things are working at the present time, and a sense of how they might work and where we might actually go. The question, of course, must arise as to what is justice. Well, again, that's a question that has troubled some of the greatest thinkers in human history for thousands of years. And again, it would be foolish of the School of Economic Science to say, well, we've got the answer, even if nobody else has. The best we can offer is some working propositions. And in this field, even working propositions are controversial. Following Plato, we would say that justice, at the very least, is a harmonious state of the soul. It's a state of the inner being of every human being. There are many who would dispute that and say justice is a state of society. To which we might respond by saying, well, if people are not at peace with themselves, it is unlikely that their societies will be peaceful either. If there isn't harmony in the people, there is unlikely to be harmony in their community. And Plato too took this view. And his exploration of the subject of justice begins by saying, as it can be quite difficult to look into oneself and find justice and injustice and discover what they are, it might be easier to look at the society in which we live and see where justice and injustice appear, and then see if we can relate that to our own inner condition. The state of society and the state of the people in society are closely linked. I think it's fair to say that we've concluded that to establish a just and equitable and stable economics, we do need some ideals. And again, it's unfashionable in this age to express ideals, to be, if you like, idealistic. One has to be realistic. But being realistic can be somewhat diminishing. It can lead us to a rather impoverished view. And sometimes it is very useful to consider what human beings are capable of, how we could live if we really put our minds to it and joined together to live well. And to do that, we have to overcome the cynicism of the present age and look for and hope for a better and brighter future for generations to come. So this harmonious state of the soul, it's one which is lawful and ordered. It allows people to flourish, and to flourish in a manner which does not impose on others and does not impose unduly on the world in which we live, the material world in which we live, the earth itself, the world of nature, from which we draw all our sustenance. It requires a vigilance, and it requires a certain self-control. Beyond saying rather generally that justice was a harmonious state of the soul, Plato tended to concentrate on what it is not. The disharmony of the soul was caused by simple things, things that we all experience. Anger, fear, pleasure, pain, jealousy, and desire were his particular list. A collection of inner tendencies which few people escape. But we all know that whether we experience them or not, we can have some control over them. We can rise above them. And when we do, we are, as it were, better people. It said we are masters of ourselves, masters of our souls. And it's that consideration that leads one to look at the economic arrangements and the economics textbooks. And one of the key features is the way economics is explained in terms of what economists call firms and households. And the basic theory is that households own the factors of production. They own land, they own labour, they own capital. And they make those available to firms, firms being the productive agents in the economy. And that at least is the way the theory goes. And the firms create wealth and then they pay it back to the households in exchange for the factors of production that they employ in the productive process. That is a highly simplified version for the purposes of this particular talk. But nevertheless, it's at the essence of the way modern economics is taught and understood. A firm, a productive enterprise, has, of course, in recent time become, in very many cases, a corporation, a notional creature which exists on paper only, but does exist independently of the people who work in it and make it up. And a household is a rather nebulous thing to an economist. It's just something to juxtapose against a firm. And to account for the collective, or rather the individual ownership, of the various factors of production. Little consideration is given to the occupants of the household, namely the householder. And we began to wonder in our consideration of justice whether more consideration might be given to that person. Because we observe that there is a gentleman who is much favoured by economists, accountants and business people and so on, called Homo economicus. Homo economicus was described in the well-known and authoritative newspaper, Metro, a couple of months ago by Rory Sutherland. Rory Sutherland is chairman of the Argyle Group of Companies, so he's a fairly senior businessman in the United Kingdom. He described Mr. Logic. Mr. Logic appears in a comic called Viz. I haven't come across this comic or Mr. Logic, but he describes him as a character bereft of interpersonal skills, incapable of understanding metaphor or context, and entirely blind to social norms. He solves problems not instinctively or intuitively, but through logical calculation. And he says, there is a place where the philosophy of Mr. Logic runs rampant in the minds of economists, accountants, policy makers, and business people. The scientific name for Mr. Logic is Homo economicus, the beast created to conceive elegant mathematical models of behaviour, but with no regard for how people behave in reality. And it's one of the features of developed economics, the very science, the subject of economics, that it puts this strange person at the heart of the matter and says this is what economics is all about. The rabbi Jonathan Sachs had something to say about that. The market gives us choices. He was writing in the Times again in December last year. The market gives us choices. So morality itself becomes just a set of evaluations. Not just to feel desire, but to ask whether this desire should be satisfied becomes redundant. We find it increasingly hard to understand why there might be things we want to do, can afford to do, and have a legal right to do, that nonetheless we should not do because they are unjust or dishonourable or disloyal or demeaning. When Homo economicus, he writes, displaces Homo sapiens, market fundamentalism rules. I was arrested by that sentence for a moment and paused to discover that sapiens means to discern, capable of discerning, wise, judicious. And the human being at the heart of all this, we would hope, is more Homo sapiens than Homo economicus. Now, the question then arises, what is the role of economics in relation to Homo sapiens, to the wise, discerning householder? Because I'm fairly certain that one thing one can safely say about economics and economic systems, and certainly about governments, is that they cannot make people wise. Just as you could, I think, safely say that they cannot make people just. The most they can do is to create the conditions in which wisdom and justice are more likely to prevail, and in which the causes of injustice, our anger, our fear, our pleasure, our pain, our jealousy and desire, are given as little rein as is possible, whilst allowing people to remain free. And I think, generally speaking, in Western societies, in the civil sphere, we have succeeded in doing this. Most people can walk down the street in many parts of the world feeling relatively secure that other people's anger and fear and so on will not burst out and cause them harm. And we certainly know the places where that is not the case, and it's highly advisable to avoid them, because human beings cannot live where these things are given free rein. But we've been less successful at this in the economic realm. We have allowed systems to develop which enable personal selfishness, I suppose, to prevail over a common good. And that's not the situation in the civil sphere, where the ordinary laws of the land apply. But to some extent it is the case in the economic sphere. And so the question that arises for us is, well, how do you create these circumstances which encourage a different conception, if you like, of economic man, or the economic being, the householder, male or female, who would be free and responsible? Free because freedom seems to be something that is inherent in the human spirit. I had a Christmas card from one of my predecessors as head of economics in the school, Mr. Roger Pinchum. And it said the usual things: Happy Christmas, peace and goodwill. And there was a little note saying, it's been a bad year for dictators. Long may it continue. And I was reminded of the old 14th century English lawyer who wrote, freedom is a thing with which the nature of man has been endowed by God. Therefore, he says, wherever it is oppressed, it strives of its own energy always to return. And as we looked at the Arab Spring spreading through last summer and autumn, and even into this winter, we see something of that playing itself out on the southern shore of the Mediterranean Sea. Something essential to the human spirit is freedom. This, of course, makes it even more difficult for economists, because it means you cannot impose. The freedom to govern includes the freedom to misgovern, and of course that has its consequences. One can proceed only really by reason and persuasion, and by pointing out consequences and pointing out the possibilities in the hope that people follow. And that is the logic of a democratic age. That's why it's heartening to see so many of you here tonight, because it shows an awakening of an interest questioning and a sense that something better could be found. So what about our householder? We want to create an economic foundation that allows people to be free, to be social and sociable, to participate in societies, because it is certainly in cooperation with others that wealth creation becomes easiest. People need to be well-founded in the sense that they are able to earn a living, an adequate living, one which provides not merely for their material good, but for the real prosperity that is built on that, namely the prosperity of happiness, well-being, and fulfillment. The sense, as I think Professor Tim Jackson put it, that all's going well with the world. That sort of prosperity. A sort of prosperity that allows people to feel that they can give more than they take and leave things better than we find them. Well, there are all sorts of obstacles, of course, to this. When people are in fear, in particular fear for their economic foundations. And even setting aside the problems of the current financial crisis, if we look beyond it, we see that there are a whole range of deeper challenges, and I'm only going to run through the list rather than try to explain them all, because otherwise we could be here for a very long time. But we know that populations are expanding, and that the relative populations are also causing difficulties. Aging populations in some places, very young populations in others. We know that there are difficulties in food distribution. Not so much production, there seems to be enough food for everybody still, but getting it to the people who need it at a price they can afford is already a major problem. So much so that a very large part of the world's population is permanently in some sort of food crisis, either undernourished or positively underfed. Water is becoming a major problem. And when water starts to run out, people do get quite violent and possessive about it. We use all sorts of industrial and agricultural processes which use up immense amounts of water. And the availability of water per head of population is becoming a serious problem around the world. The whole problem of economics based on continuous growth is also a problem, as we begin to see that even the bountiful earth has its limits, and that we need to find the ways of working within those limits. Be fruitful and multiply was the commandment given to Noah, and replenish the earth. And we often forget the latter, that the replenishment of the earth is an essential concomitant of being fruitful and multiplying. And as our populations multiply, and as our productive capacity multiplies, we need to be ever more careful of the need to replenish, because the more we take, the less there is to give. And so this giving back, this completion of the cycle of nourishment, becomes all important. And it is the only way, really, that economies can become sustainable. Then there's the almost perennial problem of the distribution of wealth. The fact is that some parts of the world's population are getting richer and richer, and others are not. They are certainly not keeping up. In some cases, things are getting better, and that is to be welcomed, but the very disparities cause their own discontents and difficulties. We see problems with energy and oil because our energy consumption has become so high. Oil, there are arguments about how much oil is left. I think we've come to the conclusion that there is quite a lot of oil left, and it may be another generation that has to really worry about whether there's enough oil. The question, and it's a very pressing one, is whether we can get it without using more energy to get it out of the ground than we can get out of the ground by using the energy. That's the real problem about oil. And then there's the problem we've created ourselves, debt, and how our money systems work based on debt. All of these are deep and profound challenges brought about by, I think, an optimism combined with a blindness about the possibilities of human progress. A blindness to the lawfulness of the world that we live in and the need to really ensure that our actions comply with the laws and take account of the laws that govern us. So all those are the deep challenges that lie behind the financial challenges of the present time. I want to look at one or two of them. In our studies in the school, we've been looking at these questions. And one of the difficulties that seems to have emerged is what we call homogenization. The tendency to lump things together and assume that they're all the same. And it seems to happen quite a lot. Gross domestic product, for example. Gross domestic product is the measure of economic activity in an economy. The measure is simply of all the economic activity, and there's no discrimination as to whether it's useful or not. You just count everything, and you count it in money terms. So everything is translated into money, and if money is created, if you can put a price on it, it counts as gross domestic product. And it doesn't really matter, for the purposes of counting, what is being produced, what is being counted. So, for example, a nation of lawyers and accountants, which never produced a morsel of food, provided someone would purchase their services, would be an apparently successful nation with a high gross domestic product. Speaking as a lawyer, I am very conscious of the fact that I do not produce anything that is terribly useful to anybody. There are a few people, happily, who will pay for some services, and that enables me to buy the things that count, like food and a place to live and clothes and the occasional holiday. But that's not really through productive effort, but nevertheless, all that people pay me to give opinions, which may or may not be terribly learned, counts as gross domestic product. It counts as the production of wealth, because our idea of wealth has been homogenized to include anything that can have a price put on it. A friend of ours in Australia did some research because the GDP in Australia seemed to be going up rather a lot, and he wondered how this was being accomplished. And what he discovered was very simple, that a lot of people were now being paid for doing the things that before they'd been doing anyway but not being paid for. Cleaning their houses, looking after children, all sorts of things like that were now being paid for that hadn't been paid for before. And as a result, GDP was expanding without anything else, anything being produced that wasn't being produced before. And that sort of lack of discrimination in the way we look at things can create the illusion that we are creating wealth when in fact we're not. And this has consequences when we start to issue money based on wealth that's being produced, the amount of wealth that's being produced. Then there's the question of capital. Capital gets homogenized as well. In strict terms, capital is tools used to create wealth, or wealth used to create more wealth. In other words, it is something that has been made and is being used to help us to make or grow more things. It's a physical entity. Tools and equipment are real capital. But to the economist, capital includes land, or at least titles to land, the right to hold land against anybody else, and it includes money. But money isn't really wealth at all, it's only a claim. And if you conflate the three together, the real capital, the tools that you need, land or titles to land, and money, and call them all capital, you lose the power of analysis that enables you to see exactly what is needed. When people say they need capital, sometimes what they need mean is they need some money. Sometimes they need money to buy capital. And sometimes they need a place to work. And all of these are different, and they have different implications for economic life. And then, of course, there's land. In economics, land is just land. It has virtually no spatial dimension at all. In fact, some have sought to write land out of the equation, saying that places like Singapore and Hong Kong have proved that land is no longer a consideration in economics. And that's because of a failure to appreciate what land actually is. Not only is it the entire natural environment, but it is also the space in which we live. One of its most evident qualities is location. And no two places are quite the same. Across the globe, every acre has its differences. And that too has immense implications, because it means that some places are significantly preferable for economic purposes than others, and some for some economic purposes, and others for other economic purposes. A fact which has received remarkably little attention in the economics of the ordinary world in which we live. And it's that sort of homogenization, a sort of failure of analysis, which actually brings about the economic difficulties that we now face. An American writer and commentator, John Greer, approached this, particularly in relation to gross domestic product, by proposing what he called a multi-tiered economy, that we should actually recognize that the economy is not one great amorphous mass, but in fact has quite different and distinct levels. The first level is the natural economy, the world of nature, which has its own cycles, its own production, its own rules. They don't vary very much. The natural cycle of production is the seasons, and there's not much we can do about those. We can, by globalizing the economy, have summer fruits available in the midst of winter, but we can't actually change the seasons. Nature has its own cycles. But not only that, nature is the source of all the wealth that's produced, at least all the material wealth. And if nature is not allowed to produce or is forced to overproduce to the point of exhaustion, then human welfare and well-being is put at risk. Often, in the way that businesses and so on account, they assume the free provision of nature, but then find that it's not that free, especially if they happen to own it and they're prepared to lease it out to somebody else. The natural economy is the foundation of the whole thing. Its health is essential to all of us. His next level of economics was what you might call the manufactured economy, the secondary economy, which takes the things that nature provides and turns them into the things that we need, into real wealth, into artifacts that are of use to human populations. And that's a different level of activity. It probably includes services, not all of which make huge demands on the natural world. Services like lawyers and so on, who need a small place to sit and an awful lot of paper. But it's that part of the economy in which human beings are most actively and creatively engaged. And it needs its own measures so that we recognize its inputs and its outputs. It needs measures which understand what is directly involved in the process and what economists call what the externalities are, what the consequences are that other people have to pick up. And then the third level of the economy is the financial economy, the wonderful world of monetary services, which are extremely useful and important in making the rest work, but have the danger of working to rules of their own. The way it was put was a simple one, really. The financial world enjoys what are called positive feedbacks. I think they're called, I always get the positive and negative mixed up, but the positive feedback, it goes like this. You get into debt. That is a problem. You should do something about the debt. In the ordinary world, you would say the negative feedback would be, right, well, we'll pay off the debt. But the wonders of the financial economy allow us to take a different view and say, we'll deal with the debt by borrowing more. See what I mean? And in doing so, you increase the propensity to be in debt, and you increase the amount of money that's in circulation. This becomes possible when the financial world is divorced from the natural world and the manufactured or made economy. But it does create dangers for monetary systems everywhere, because when money is no longer related to things it can buy, it loses its value. And when it loses its value, it becomes useless. And people who and economies which have spent a great deal of time accumulating monetary wealth find themselves extremely exposed, because money is just a claim on wealth. And if there is no wealth to claim, the money is not worth much. We think there may be something in this analysis. We're exploring it. We think it offers the opportunity of dealing much more intelligently with the different aspects of economic life in a way which would allow people, and after all, essentially it's all about people, to flourish. And in this, we take a view that the land, which includes the whole natural environment, is of central importance, far more importance than it is generally given in economics textbooks. We do so because of the complete dependence that we all have on the natural world, because we are, in fact, a part of the natural world. We have our human nature, and it interacts with the rest of nature as one complete whole. And so it follows that as human beings, like all beings, we need access and cannot survive without access to the natural environment. And the big issues that are arising in the world around us, as they have done in recent centuries more and more, is the terms upon which people have access to land. One solution would be just to nationalise the lot. But one has to ask whether it is consistent with a free and secure society that the government owns the land, because, of course, the person who owns land has the greatest power, the complete power over everybody. People do need access to land, and they need security of tenure. You need to be able to say, well, this is my bit. But how you deal with that gives, I think, a pointer to how the economics of a free householder might really begin to work. We have to recognise that obligations come with exclusive possession, that the basis upon which one is able to hold against the rest of the world a particular part of the world is the simple basis that we fulfill economic duties towards the rest of the world. And that, in fact, as ordinary citizens, we have a right to expect that those who hold land fulfill those duties. And this is much easier to see when we take account of the spatial dimension of land that was being spoken of earlier. Because one effect of this spatial dimension and the differences in different places is that it creates different advantages and disadvantages in different places. And that, in turn, allows us to distinguish, just about, in a general sort of way, between what is genuinely the fruit of a person's efforts and what is actually the fruit of an advantage they hold over everybody else. And the simple obligation is to return that advantage to the community as a whole, and that can be done through a tax system. The tax system that is described, or is most usually described for doing it, is a system of taxation of land values. The language itself becomes complicated. It's sometimes referred to as a land tax, although it isn't a tax on land at all. It's a tax on value. It's a tax, in a way, on the desirability of a particular location. A tax, if you like, on desire. Most commonly, it's described as a tax on the economic rent of land. But the term economic rent has become so generalised and homogenised that it's quite difficult even to use that, because few economists agree on precisely what it means. And fewer recognise that when it's applied to something like land, the term is applied to something like land, it is describing something slightly different to the same term applied to something like a particular personal ability. Some people are able to command high incomes because of their particular abilities. One thinks of Bill Gates, for example. One thinks of the football players, the pop stars, the people, the superstars who manage to attract lots of money by their abilities. They're not depriving anybody else by using those abilities. They're simply selling an ability that they have to people who enjoy their performance or enjoy the service that they provide. And that's the economic rent that they have. They have an advantage over the rest of us because they do it better. Well, I think I would say in a free society, good luck to them. But when their advantage derives simply from being able to prevent people from doing what they otherwise could do, then it's different. We might say it's not so just or even unjust. Because the nature itself is here for all of us. If there's a principle at the heart of it, it is that the land belongs to no one. We can't take it with us, we can't keep it, and we didn't create it. So there's an obligation that goes with the occupation of it. And I do stress, I'm not suggesting that you can't occupy land, because of course we must. All this is being said is that there are obligations that go with it. And that leads to a consideration of the whole question of revenue, particularly public revenue, and taxation. Once again, it's interesting that the economics textbooks pay little attention to what is known as the incidence of taxation, the effect of particular taxes in different places. And this again is a result, I think, of not really appreciating the whole spatial dimension of land and therefore of an economy. And so you see it. We saw it a few years ago when, for very sound reasons, the government took the view that it would be good to incrementally increase the tax on petrol, because it was hoped that increasing petrol prices would cause people to use their cars less, as indeed they are now doing. The difference being that it's not merely the tax that's causing the difficulties, it's changes in oil prices and the whole world economic situation. And where did the protests start to come from? They came from the margins of the economy, the places where people's margins were tightest, the places where it was most difficult to create enough wealth to live on. And it came from there because it was there that the tax had the most impact. And most taxes have an impact like that. It's much easier to meet taxes in some places than in others. And one of the effects of taxation is to increase the cost of everything, because somehow or other the tax has to be paid. A study carried out in the school about 20 years ago into the coal industry in the United Kingdom showed that the reason why the coal industry effectively had to be closed down was because the amount of tax paid by the then nationalised industry to the then government was sufficient to make the price of coal coming out of UK mines more expensive than coal coming from open cast mines in Colombia and other places in South America. And the result was that the coal industry was rendered uncompetitive by the tax system. But few people actually listened to that analysis. But we actually taxed our coal industry out of existence. And it's only just beginning to recover now that the price of coal has gone up enough to meet the burden of taxes, as well as the price that people are prepared to pay for coal. Close examination of the tax system begins to show that it is possible to relate the public revenue to the productivity of different places rather than of different people. And that can be done through a tax on land values. It may be that we have to be more ingenious than that. The economic rent of land is certainly being collected. Somebody's getting it. It's not that we are trying to find a new source of wealth or a new source of revenue. The wealth is being created. The rent is being collected. And those who can collect the rent, who are described by economists as rent seekers, do very well. The ability to collect the economic rent of land enables people to become very rich and is one of the reasons for the immense disparities between rich and poor, one which a just tax system might do something to redress and needs to, because studies in various parts of the world are showing again and again that it is not absolute wealth that actually causes discontent and dissatisfaction in societies. It is disparities. It seems that up to a certain level, increases in material prosperity are very important. Happiness indexes show a very steep rise as material circumstances improve, but only up to a certain point. Thereafter, it levels out. People don't get any happier by the production of more wealth once a certain standard of living is achieved. And it's not a particularly high standard of living. Most of us probably exceed it. What does cause difficulties is when people see that other people are doing much, much better than they are. That's what causes discontent. And in a way, that's what caused the discontents that resulted in the Arab Spring I was speaking about a little while ago. The tax system can be used as a very subtle instrument to deal with that. But it does need to be very intelligently examined in order to do so. And that seems to be the primary art of government, or a primary art of government, to be able to so use the tax system as to level out the inequalities in the accumulation of wealth in a state. Not to the extent of making everybody the same or insisting that everybody only has the same income or anything of that kind, but to the extent that the disparities do not become so great as to cause discontent in the state. Because, as we said, there are limits to what governments can do. They can't make people happy, but they can create conditions in which people are more likely to be happy. They cannot create contentment, but they can create conditions in which people are more likely to be content. They can't even make peace. They can only make war or stop. I think that understanding this, that there are limits to what governments can do, and that there is a huge onus on people as a result, is something that has rather got lost in the last century or so from the way that we actually think about our lives. The interaction, if you like, between people and government has changed. The government has become the great provider. Justice itself has become a function of government, when in reality it is a personal virtue. And so we go to the government and demand justice. And perhaps it's the wrong place. Somebody described politicians as people who are very keen to change the world but don't want to change themselves. And in a way, that's at the back of many modern cries for justice. The justice that we want is to be as we are without changing. But what the present situation really calls for is some careful self-examination by our human population and by our Western population of the standards by which we live and whether in fact those standards can be sustained. There comes a time when people have to become independent and not dependent, when people have to be responsible for themselves and not expect others to meet their responsibilities. I don't think it's going too far to say that that time has probably come, that we can no longer continue to demand of governments that they provide more and more for the people, but rather to demand that they provide the conditions in which people can provide more and more for themselves. And it's that sense that we ascribe to the householder of what we would see as a reformed economic outlook, and creating the conditions in which a free, independent householder, inspired by justice, is most likely to thrive, seems to be a proper aspiration of government. And the science of economics ultimately is a servant of government. Not of business or of individuals, but of government. It's a science of government. It's about creating those conditions. Without doing so, I dare say that we'll get out of the present crisis one way or another, more or less successfully. There will be another period when things all seem to be going swimmingly, at least where we are. But then it will all happen again. But there now does seem to be a lot of people asking for more than that and asking for better than that. And I think we would do well to heed those voices, and economists would do well, and us in the School of Economic Science would do well to listen to those voices and do our utmost to see the way through to a more just, a more equitable economic order. So those are the thoughts that are at least pressing amongst the economists in the school at the present time. They're intended to meet the demands of the age that we live in, and I hope that we will continue to do so, because ultimately that's what we're here for, to be of service to the world, to the community in which we live, through our studies in economics. So thank you for listening so patiently. If there's time, there probably is a bit, then I'd be happy to see if there are any questions. So thank you.